The Bush administration is drafting a new policy on the military uses of space. An article in the New York Times last week reported that the Air Force wants the White House to approve a new presidential directive that would move the United States closer to the deployment of offensive and defensive weapons in space, some intended to protect American satellites used for reconnaissance and communications, some that could blind or disable other countries' satellites, and others designed to strike targets on the Earth. The report quoted then-acting Secretary of the Air Force Pete Tietz as telling a space warfare symposium last year, "We haven't reached the point of bombing and strafing from space. Nonetheless, we are thinking about those possibilities." White House spokesman Scott McClellan said last Wednesday that the new policy does not call for the weaponization of space. "There are treaties in place," McClellan said, "and we continue to abide by those treaties." Later in the program, the opening of a new pipeline to carry oil from the Caspian to the Mediterranean, and a kid who knows all the countries it runs through, the winner of today's National Geography Bee. But first, the military uses of space. If you have questions about what's under consideration, what's possible, what's legal, and what's wise, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin with Tim Weiner, a reporter for The New York Times, who wrote last week's story. He's with us from his office in New York City. Nice to have you on the program.
Hello there.
Your story has another quote, this one from General Lance Lord, the head of Space Command, and he told Congress, "We must establish and maintain space superiority." What does he mean by that?
He means the ability to fight from space, through space, and in space.
And by superiority, he means the United States, if there's going to be warfare from space, in space, the United States should prevail.
Certainly.
What exactly does the Air Force want to do?
Well, I think we need to separate out what is Air Force doctrine and strategy from what is national policy and what is technologically possible. The history of the Cold War is full of ambitious ideas from Air Force generals about doing things like putting nuclear weapons on the moon, or building a military space plane to be powered by atomic bombs.
Mm-hmm.
The Air Force, or certain leaders of the Air Force, do see space as a strategic commons rather than a global commons, and one where the United States, since we have very important, very expensive space satellites for reconnaissance, spying, communications, intelligence, surveillance, that are crucial to conducting global military operations, that at minimum we need ways to protect them, but at maximum we need the ability to use space as a battleground. This has been a technological goal for at least 10 years. In 1996, Air Force General Joseph Ashy said, "We're going to fight in space. We're going to fight from space, and we're going to fight into space. And we will engage terrestrial targets, ships, airplanes, land targets, from space." Now, that's an idea. How do ideas and strategies get translated into policy? They need to be adapted by the president, they need to be endorsed by the Secretary of Defense, and they need to be financed by Congress and the taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, and as you said, there is an important distinction to be made between Air Force doctrine and national policy.
Indeed. Now, second part of the puzzle. After more than 3 years of debate, the White House is getting ready to rewrite military space policy. And the kind of the document that is the foundation for this rewrite is the work of a commission that was led by Don Rumsfeld, then the newly nominated Secretary of Defense, back in January 2001, which recommended that the military should, quote, "ensure that the president will have the option to deploy weapons in space." Now, they were talking about weapons in space. Not all space weapons are weapons in space. In other words, if you have a laser on the ground that bounces off a mirror on a satellite in space, down to Earth, that's not a weapon in space.
Mm-hmm.
It is a space weapon. If you have a military space plane that is armed with rockets, missiles, munitions, in what's called on the drawing board the common aero vehicle, and that plane is sitting on the ground and launched in a crisis, transits space, and fires down at the ground, that's not a weapon in space. It is a space weapon, though.
And people would say that reconnaissance satellites aren't weapons, yet, it's espionage. You're spying on people.
And that's different from blowing them up.
Yep. It is. And one of the things that the Air Force has indeed talked about, indeed experimented to some degree, at least according to your article, is with space satellites that could interfere with other countries' space satellites.
There is a satellite that was launched in April called the XSS-11, the Experimental Space Satellite, 11th in a series, that has the technical, theoretical ability to disrupt other satellites. It's a micro-satellite and kind of creeps up to other satellites and right now just looks at them.
Mm-hmm. But it does have the potential?
If you put, you know, the 21st century equivalent of a gun on it, yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned, obviously, there are political hurdles. First, the policy hurdle at the White House, then political hurdles with Congress. But there are also important diplomatic ramifications here.
Well, yes and no. There's nothing that prohibits, at this point, the United States from putting these kinds of systems into play. There were prohibitions in the anti-ballistic missile treaty against space-based anti-ballistic missile weapons, but the United States withdrew from that in 2002.
Let's hear some more on that issue. Joining us now is Joanne Garbrinowitz, editor-in-chief of the Journal of Space Law. She joins us now from the studios of member station WGUC in Cincinnati, Ohio. Nice of you to be with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And is Tim Weiner right? There's no treaty that restrains the United States from putting weapons in space?
Actually, there are five treaties, four of them which are relevant. The main one and the most important one is the Outer Space Treaty, which has currently 98 states have ratified it and another 27 have signed it. And that specifically deals with the military use of space. It breaks space into two components, open space and the moon and celestial bodies. In open space, there is a specific ban on nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction. Those include atomic, biological, and chemical weapons. And on the moon, there's a complete prohibition of aggressive activities. It has to be used for peaceful purposes, and it specifically is prohibiting military bases, installations, fortifications, weapons testings, and military maneuvers. Now, the main legal issue.
If I may jump in, the United States is not talking about putting nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction in space.
Or building bases on the moon at this point.
Right. But where the issue comes down is the argument is that conventional weapons are permitted in space, and that has two prongs to it. On one side of the argument is if it's a conventional weapon, then that's allowed. The response to that is, but does the greater advanced technology, speed, and efficiency of modern conventional weapons make them the functional equivalent of weapons of mass destruction? If so, then you have to look at the treaty and the purpose as a whole, mm-hmm. which is to keep space a stable environment.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I did want to ask Tim Weiner, though. One of the Air Force projects that you talked about was the so-called rods from God.
That's a kinetic weapon. That's just an object hurled from space.
Yet it would hit with the explosive force of a small nuclear weapon.
In theory, it would explode with the force of tons of TNT, but it's not a nuclear weapon.
I understand.
But legally, you have to look at it a little more broadly. What the treaties provide is that all nations have the right to use and explore space, and no nation can interfere with another nation's use of space. So the questions of what constitutes a weapon aside, you have the legal protection of signatories to use space. And if any nation is engaged in activities which inhibits or prevents or destroys another signatory's use of space, that is a legal infraction. There's also the environmental elements of the Outer Space Treaty, which says signatories will do no harm to the environment. So if any of these activities, regardless of their classification, have environmental impacts, for example, the propagation of orbital debris, that is another legal issue. Mm-hmm. So you can't just hook your analysis on what kind of weapon it is and what you call it. You have to take it in the context of the right to use, the right to explore, the environmental ramifications, and the fact that no nation under the treaty regime has the right or authority to prevent another nation from using space.
Tim Weiner, before we let you go, when is the Bush administration expected to issue this new presidential directive?
Well, I was told it was a matter of weeks, but these things take time. I would expect it to be in a couple of months.
In a couple of months. So before the summer is out, we're likely to get a new policy?
I think so.
And you've also said that the Air Force has quietly spent millions of dollars on these projects already.
Well, there are many rooms in the mansion of the research and development of 21st century weapons. And yes, over the past decade or so, there you could add it up into several billion.
Tim Weiner, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Tim Weiner covering the space defense story for the New York Times. He joined us from his office in New York City. And we'd also like to thank Joanne Garbrinowitz, editor-in-chief of the Journal of Space Law, who was kind enough to come into the studios of member station WGUC in Cincinnati, Ohio. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to hear arguments from both sides of the debate over weapons and space. And we'll take your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The U.S. policy on the militarization of space is up for review. There are calls both to beef up the military presence in space and to keep space weapons free. We're looking at the issues this hour. Of course, you're invited to join us if you have a question about the military goals, international rules, or technological possibilities in space. Also, the financial possibilities. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Teresa Hitchens, Vice President for the Center for Defense Information. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us from his office in Montgomery, Alabama, is Everett Dolman, Associate Professor of Comparative Military Studies at the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies. And it's nice of you to be with us as well.
Thank you.
And Everett Dolman, let's begin with you. What are the arguments for increasing the weaponization of space?
Well, the critical point here is the pace of what is being referred to as military transformation. At least since Vietnam, and certainly officially in the last half decade, the United States military has been moving towards a fourth generation or a 21st century kind of warfare that is going to be precision in its focus. It is going to be fast moving. It is going to have global reach, and it is going to be lethal. The only way that the military can transform to this particular structure is with the benefits that it gets from space, from navigation, from communications, from surveillance, and the like. The protection of space, then, as the critical infrastructure, the critical point of this transformation, is of vital interest to the military.
So, for example, the guided bombs that are being dropped today in Iraq and Afghanistan use global positioning satellite technology. If those satellites aren't there, those bombs go, as they say, dumb.
Well, they are. In fact, they are dumb bombs that have been enhanced by global positioning satellites, where perhaps once they could land within several tens of meters of their target, now they are coming within 3 meters of their target. And in fact, they are so precise that in Iraq and Afghanistan recently, you're getting a close battle support from B-52s dropping bombs at 15,000 feet.
Teresa Hitchens, if satellites like those GPS satellites are so important to our military, why shouldn't we look into defending them?
Of course we should look into defending them, but anti-satellite weapons and space-based weapons do very little, next to nothing, to actually defend your satellites. Those are offensive systems, and a large part of the doctrine and strategy that proponents of space weapons are putting forward has to do with offense, not defense. There are other ways of protecting your satellites, and there are things that we ought to be looking into right now. That includes things like protections against hacking and jamming, which is one of the easiest ways to take down a satellite. It includes a whole host of technological capabilities that could be added to our systems. It also includes making sure that space is not what the military calls a single-point failure. And that means that you should not have space systems, which are highly vulnerable, indeed, being the only provider of a certain capability. You want to have redundant capabilities. That means, for example, looking into what the Air Force is looking into, using UAVs for tactical communications on the ground.
Unmanned aerial vehicles,
right.
So UAVs.
Right.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. So your questions are probably at least as good as mine. Let's begin with John. John's with us from Sacramento, California.
How you doing, Neil?
All right.
I got kind of a two-part question, I guess, for both your guests. The first part of the question is, who or what countries have the technology to really truly threaten our satellite communications? And the second part is, you know, how serious of a threat would they be in the long term?
Everett Dolman, where's the threat?
Well, the threat is there today. We know in Iraq there were satellite jammers that were purchased and used by the Iraqis. Threats exist from any country that has a medium-range ballistic missile or smaller to launch into space and try to corrupt the low Earth orbit. The biggest threats that we have today are from missile launches, from terrorists, from accidental launches, from rogue states, and what is rarely looked into is third-party-to-third-party launches, say an India-Pakistan war going nuclear and drawing in the United States.
Teresa, is there a reasonable threat that needs to be addressed, do you think?
I don't think jammers can be considered space weapons. They've been around for a very long time.
It's not
that technology doesn't exist today to disrupt certain things, but we do have ways of preventing that from happening. So there's a disconnect in the argument that because there are threats to satellites, we actually need space weapons. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't follow.
Well, if I might, there has been no purely defensive strategy that has ever worked. And certainly I agree with Ms. Hitchens. The defensive points that she's trying to make are very valuable to the Air Force and need to be done. However,
as I understood it,
weapons are necessary.
I'm sorry, John, now you can go ahead.
As I understood, the GPS jammers, is that what you're referring to? The Russian-made GPS jammers?
Yeah, I believe
recall,
that's it, yeah.
Those didn't work very well, if at all.
Not particularly well, no.
Now, that's what I recall hearing on the news, that there's a big deal because the Russians sold them to the Iraqis, but they didn't even really work.
Well, John, other than Russian technology is available, presumably even Russian technology is getting better, and as we look ahead to the future, the world may change and capabilities may change. These systems take a long time to develop.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much for the call. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Dan. Dan's with us from Macomb, Illinois.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was hoping you could satisfy a couple of just general scientific questions I had. As far as boundaries that each nation or groups of nations have for technology they have in space, how does that actually work?
What are the boundaries in space? 23,000 miles up, are there any national borders, Everett Dolman?
Well, the demarcation point where space actually begins has never been settled by international treaty. There's a level where air-powered flight powered flight in the air can take place, and there's a level where the lowest point of an orbit without additional power can take place, and then there's a no-man's land in between there. There are laws of the air in which a national territory extends up to the sky, but in space, the current regime does not allow for any national appropriation.
Teresa Hitchens, there is, though, a concept of the sovereignty of satellites.
That's correct. There is a concept, and it's not only a national concept in the United States. It is an internationally accepted dictum that a satellite belongs to whom it belongs to and it is to be kept free from interference from other people.
So though space is a global commons, that's a U.S. satellite or a Russian satellite or a Japanese satellite or an Israeli satellite.
Or a commercial industry satellite.
Dan, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Hugo. Hugo's with us is that Livingston, New Jersey?
Correct, sir.
Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Quick question. What is the potential, the political possibilities that this new technology and the steps that the United States is taking to its implementation that is going to launch us into a new weapons race, very much like during the Cold War with nuclear weapons? And pretty soon, you know, we're going to have a situation where countries are going to say, well, if, you know, the only power in the world that did use nuclear weapons is going around telling others when to have them and how to have them, take the situation with Israel. What does this mean for the future of the world, particularly with small nations that don't have this technology? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Hugo. Teresa Hitchens, the possibility of an arms race.
Well, it's a very good question, and I hesitate to use the term arms race because it evokes like powers, the Soviet Union and the United States, of almost equal capability. And that might not happen anytime soon since the U.S. is pretty well advanced over most other nations in their space capabilities. But that said, once weapon systems are deployed, developed and deployed, they are followed by other weapon systems. In other words, space weapons will beget space weapons. Other countries will pursue technologies to damage or destroy those weapons. So, yes, you're starting a military competition where none exists today. That, in my mind, isn't a very smart military or strategic strategy. It doesn't make sense to start a competition and that you might not have to enter into. So I think that that's a problem. On the issue of international reaction, I think it's pretty clear that already the rest of the world is feeling a little bit antsy about the U.S. Dominant power as a dominant military power in the world. And I think that a unilateral move to weaponized space would really scare everyone. And particularly when you're talking about things that could be overhead 24/7, strike the ground in a couple of minutes, that's a really scary prospect for other countries, whether they're our allies or our potential enemies. And certainly I think it would result in some very severe political and probably economic ramifications as other countries gang together to figure out ways to stop the global galactic empire.
Mm-hmm. Everett Dolman, we have heard already questions from not just European Union, but Canada, Russia, China?
Yeah, I find it curious that opponents of space weapons will tell us that they're inefficient, they won't work, they don't help, they don't provide any capability. And then on the other hand, if we do deploy space weapons, we'll be putting the rest of the world under our thumb as part of a general empire. There's a long argument that the amount of money spent on space weapons would be coming from other parts of the military budget that would make that kind of an empirical domination quite impossible. But let me get to the issue of the arms race. Today there is no peer competitor as there was during the Cold War with the Soviet Union. If the United States were to put weapons into space today and in effect seize low Earth orbit and use those weapons, as Teresa points out, in an offensive mode or be willing to use those, it could prevent other states, when they do get the capability to build weapons, from going there. In other words, there's no space race that is quite possible now with the United States dominance. If the United States, however, waits 10 years, 15 years, other states will have caught up, will be able to compete, and there will be a space race. In my view, taking space now and for the good of the world, the global commons as it's called, and administering that is the solution for all global commons problems, is a reasonable thing. Now, if the argument is whether or not the United States should be the hegemon is on the table, well, that's a different argument. The fact is the United States is the hegemon, and putting weapons in space will extend that period of hegemony into the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. Teresa Hitchens, there is another approach that people have talked about, and that is to the United States, with this hegemonic power that it does have now, could use that position to try to negotiate a treaty on space that would keep the status quo and keep the United States able to use space for military purposes as it does now, but constrain everyone from putting weapons in space.
Yes, that's true, and in my mind that's a much better solution than thinking about the United States as the empire beating back the hordes of barbarians for the rest of my natural life and that of my sons and my grandsons. I would rather live in a world that's ruled by law, if that's possible. And whereas everyone knows that people break laws, you know, people run stoplights, things happen, people break treaties, but laws do actually slow down problems, they prevent problems. A treaty of some sort at this point would be possible because no other nation indeed is close enough to compete right now. So it would be in their interest to go there. It would be in our interest to have a treaty so that we don't end up 20 or 30 years from now with a situation where space is bristling with weapons on hair trigger and you have a very unstable situation. So it seems to me, because the status quo actually favors the United States in space right now, that it makes sense for us, it would be a more rational, a more prudent, and certainly a more economic approach to try to extend that status quo through economic and legal means as long as we possibly can.
We're talking about the implications of the weaponization of space, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Everett Dolman, I did want to ask you to come in on that argument. Would a treaty be a useful alternative?
Well, I agree with Teresa. I think it's much better to live under rule of law, and that a lawful society is a much better one, whether that be a society of states or people. The fact is, in international society, the only time that we have had strong, peaceful rule of law is when a hegemonic power establishes that law and then takes upon itself the duties of keeping it. If we look at the law of the sea, for example, a very robust law that was put into place by the British and the Dutch in their periods of dominance on the sea and was maintained by them. Today, the United States has dominant power in the air and on the seas and in the land where it puts its forces. And the United States goes about the business of making sure the sea lanes are open to all traders, that it goes and crosses into areas that are in dispute, such as the line of death of Libya several years ago, mm-hmm. to make sure that those things stay open. A hegemonic power, a strong power willing to use its police capacity, and this is a police force, a space cop type of idea, can make the global heavens an exploitable resource for all, whereas right now there is no guarantee even that if a corporation or a nation should go into space and find wealth there, that it could keep it or have a reasonable share of keeping it.
Let's see if we get one more caller in. Richard joins us. Richard's in San Francisco.
Hi. My comment was briefly that I think the United States, in the hegemonic role that it's in, would abide by international treaties preventing the weaponization of space until such time as it became inconvenient to do so, similar to the ABM treaty. When they felt the need to develop anti-ballistic missile systems, they simply withdrew from the treaty. And I believe that a similar thing would happen in the case of treaties governing the weaponization of space.
So that you don't think a treaty would be useful?
I don't think a treaty would be useful. Then there's also the related problem of others cheating on treaties or non-signatory. So I think the United States is in a position where it cannot depend on a treaty to prevent the weaponization of space for the future.
Richard, thanks very much for your comment. We appreciate it. Before we let you go, Everett Dolman, I did want to ask, what do you expect and maybe what do you hope that this new presidential directive will say?
Well, I think the rhetoric of the new directive is not going to be a great distance or a great leap from the current one. I am hoping that it will allow the Air Force to develop the capacity to use weapons should it prove necessary. Now, the reason this is valid is the Air Force has been given the mission of protecting and ensuring space assets, not only for itself, for the rest of the world, to tell the Air Force, a military martial organization, to do that without using weapons is irresponsible.
And let me ask you, Teresa Hitchens, do you believe that this new directive will lead to weapons in space?
I do. And I think that that's a very big mistake on the part of the United States, because I certainly believe that doing so will endanger not only international security, but U.S. security in the long run. We will create problems that we don't have now, and I think that that's a dangerous game.
Thank you both very much. Everett Dolman is Associate Professor of Comparative Military Studies at the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama, and he joined us from Montgomery, Alabama. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And Teresa Hitchens, President of the Center for Defense Information, joined us here in Studio 3A. Appreciate you coming in.
Thanks a lot for having me.
When we come back from the break, we'll be talking about a new geopolitical reality, a pipeline to carry oil from the Caspian to the Mediterranean Sea. And we'll also be talking about the deciding issue in today's National Geography Bee, a dammed river in Panama. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.